Theme for today is academics at Washington and Lee, and my first question has to do with the Leyburn plan proposed by just arrived Dean Leyburn. Is that right?
That's correct.
So tell me what you know about the Leyburn plan.
Well, the Leyburn plan has been talked about for many years at Washington Lee. It was a much more frequent topic of discussion in the first years that I worked here because I came to Washington Lee as a student in 1949, just almost 2 years after Dr. Leyburn made his memorable talk to the Faculty Discussion Club in November of 1947. The Leyburn plan, like I say, was talked about around the campus. Some faculty members were greatly in admiration of it, others were not. He, in effect, on that evening, while I haven't committed the plan to memory, but in effect that evening, he told Washington Lee's faculty that the university, while a splendid institution on the basis of many levels of evaluation, it nevertheless was not nearly as good as it could be and indeed should be. And he went on to spell out chapter and verse as to what he thought the major shortcomings of the institution were, and he laid out for debate, not necessarily these, he didn't present these as recommendations, but he laid out these topics for debate among the faculty over the following days, weeks, and months, perhaps even years, certain specific issues that they should address to see if Washington Lee could indeed aspire to be the foremost teaching institution in the United States, certainly one of the better teaching institutions. And from that point on, then, I think Washington Lee did have a new assessment of itself, if indeed there is such thing as a depersonalized institutional assessment of itself. When I say Washington Lee had an assessment of itself, I mean the faculty, students, and eventually alumni, I think, came to appreciate the goals that he established on that evening for the institution. In embracing these goals, I do not think that those who did so were always aware that they were joining in their attitudes with Dean Leyburn.
Tell me what you mean by that.
Well, I mean, Dean Leyburn just simply said that we've got to be proud of more things here, for instance, than our football team, our fancy dress balls, and our fraternity system. Those weren't his exact words, but that essentially was were three things he cited there that we wanted to be proud of and noted for the challenging educational program that we would offer them. And he suggested that maybe while we had many good faculty members, many good professors, but there were ways in which we could improve the status of our faculty. He suggested ways in which we could improve our curriculum. He was particularly dismayed by the absence of fine arts from our curriculum at that time. And I think one of his lasting elements of professional satisfaction was that he was responsible for bringing the first professor of fine arts to Washington Lee. And at that time, you could count the professors, some from other departments who would offer sort of peripheral courses, sort of in the arts. There was a growth that began then that results now in a very firmly established faculty in the fine arts and in the performing arts as well. So he did begin something that he would be very pleased with the way it manifests itself on the campus now.
So, one thing that I think is very interesting about your perspective is that Dean Leyburn laid out this challenge in 1947. You arrived on the campus in 1949, and with the exception of your period going off to Korea, you've been here as a witness through all the ensuing years. What's your sense of whether Dean Leyburn's ideas have been accomplished or not? I mean, I know you've spoken to that somewhat, but...
Well, I think in large dimension, this is one of the things I'm interested in following up and seeking the opinions of others.
Has it been a steady... through the time you've been here, has it been a steady achievement, or...?
Yes, I would say that the trend line has always been upward from that time. That I don't think there has been a period, even when we were undergoing some rather rigorous pressures in the admissions process, when our applicants slipped below 1,000. Even then, I think the quality of the great majority of our students proved to be as good as we had ever had. It was at that time and in some of the following years that we did have to dip deeper and deeper into our applicant pool to produce a class, and that in dipping deeper, well, we were dredging up some students that did not challenge our professors and did not meet the educational opportunities here head on like they should be capable of doing. So I think over the years, though, that the trend line has been a steady improvement. And let me cite something that happened not long after I came to work at Washington and Lee. There was always the assumption, let me say this too, there was always the assumption when I was a student at Washington Lee that we, meaning my classmates and I, were attending the premier teaching institution in the state of Virginia. Everyone seemed to be aware that, with the possible exception of Mr. Jefferson's academical village on the other side of the mountain, and of course the University of Virginia was a much larger institution even then, even more so, well, I guess the ratio was probably, the size differential is greater today than it was then, but even so, it was a full-blown university, and Washington Lee was a college with a law school. So we felt like we were attending the best school in Virginia, perhaps the best school in the South. We thought we were one of the best schools in the country. We didn't always have the perspective for that kind of an evaluation that youngsters might have, but nevertheless, that was our feeling. I remember shortly after I came in as a freshman, it may have been my freshman year, one of Dean Leyburn's recommendations or debate topics seemed to come to pass, and that was there was a humanities course that was introduced as sort of a senior capstone course, that all seniors would be required to take this course, in addition to some of the rather rigorous requirements that were imposed on freshmen. A senior would also have to take this course, and it would be a course in the general humanities that would attempt to somehow bring together, for a better understanding on the part of these soon-to-be graduates, as to what education should have done for them. For many, it would be a sort of underscoring what they'd missed. For others, it might be a very useful exercise. I recall among my fellow students at that time a certain dismay over this, and I recall my own sense of relief when I heard others complain about it, and I recall my own sense of relief that I would be able to graduate under the catalog for the year in which I had entered. And that since this was a change in the catalog, after I had entered, I wouldn't have to abide by it. I could meet the requirements for the freshman who came in 1949, and I wouldn't have to contend with with the requirements that had cropped up in 1951 when I came back from Korea. And as I recall, there was sufficient controversy over the success of that senior requirement that it did not last long. I can't put my finger on the date now when it passed away, but it didn't last too long.
Sounds like a great course to me. I'd love to take it.
Well, I think the purposes of that course are met in other ways here now. We have some interdisciplinary courses that have come about over the years that achieve some of its goals. We have a great variety of seminar courses now that sometimes address multiple disciplinary subjects. And in some of the departments, while this isn't the total answer to, or the total companion to his humanities course, there are some departments that require comprehensive examinations that try to bring together all the things that were taught within that department, at least in a coherent way, challenging the students to think coherently about what they've been exposed to. So again, these were things that were on his mind. I'm certain all of these things were on his mind. And in my general conclusion here, subject to some further study and confirmation, is that if Dr. Laburn were alive today and come back and look at Washington Lee's curriculum, to examine the credentials of its faculty, to be aware of what they are doing in the way of scholarship and professional self-development, if he were to look upon the university and see the multiple co-curricular activities, the publications that students are engaged in, he would be very proud of what Washington Lee has become. And I knowing him, he would never take much credit for that, other than the role he played when he was one of the best, but I'd go on and say he was our premier professor for many years. That I would say that probably more students among our alumni look to him as the quintessential Washington Lee professor than any other single person. I can't say that I can do that because I never took a course from him. Again, I was greatly persuaded by attitudes of others. He challenged his students, and having started late to college, I'm a little ashamed to admit this, but I wasn't looking for too many challenges. I wanted to get out of college and get on with my life.
And you're still here, Frank.
I'm still here. Yes, I'm still here. But I could have taken a much richer course of study here than I did. I took a very nice course of study. I was preparing myself for a profession in journalism, and I had a good break in that. Oh, another one of the finest teachers we've ever had here, Tom Riegel, was one of my mentors, and thanks to him, I was able to take all of the advanced courses that I chose to take in journalism without the prerequisites, because I had come into Washington Lee with a substantial amount of newspapering experience, and he was kind enough to not require me to take beginner's reporting and intermediate reporting and copy editing, because I had done all this. So I actually majored in what is now called politics, what was then called political science. And I did that on the recommendation of a newspaper correspondent friend of mine when I was in Korea, who said that I should consider majoring in something other than journalism, that I would be wasting my time taking some of these basic journalism major courses that I'd already proven my ability to work alongside professional newsmen and to do so in a creditable manner. And he suggested I major in English or history or economics or political science, and whereupon he said, yeah, my political science. He said, 90% of what you read in the newspapers is either international relations, government, or politics. He says, the other 10% is sex and violence. You can study that on your own. Well, What I think is, if Nate Paluski were around today, he would agree with me that I think the balance between international relations, government and politics has reached out and embraced violence and sex, and it's all intertwined, and so political sciences or politics is as good a major for studying the human condition as anything you can find. So I did major in that, but again, pointing up Dr. Laban's vantage point on this, the political science department at that time was not the strongest department in the university. I hesitate to say it was even good. One didn't discover this until you were deeply engaged in the in the study of political science. And some of the professors that I encountered in the political science department are among really fondly remembered individuals. In the case of one, he's a virtual Washington and Lee saint, but not because he was a good professor, because of other things he did while he was here. Mm-hmm. And it was a very unchallenging major. And so I'm counted both as a major in political science and over in the journalism department as well, because I took enough courses in journalism to qualify as a major. I just took the more advanced ones.
Now, you've used the word challenge several times and in different ways, and I think that's an interesting word. I liked what you were, earlier when we were talking about the admissions, you said that there were students coming in who didn't challenge the faculty.
Mm-hmm.
Now, was there a shift that, say, when, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but when Laban arrived, that the faculty didn't care about being challenged, but as new people came in, they were more interested in having better students?
The best professors here like to teach bright students. That was true then. I think it's always been true here. It certainly became true in the years, I'd say during the 70s and 80s, when we were dealing with admissions changes, and we were, because of our all-male status and because we were trying to seek good students, we were seeing our admissions numbers go up, but we were having to admit more in order to make a class. And this resulted in students coming in that were essentially dullards in class. And I can say almost across the board that why our faculty in the 70s, when we pondered coeducation in several earlier studies, the great majority of them felt that they were not being challenged. They wanted to teach across the board a brighter student body, and they saw coeducation as one of the best ways to achieve that.
Okay, well, let's make that shift into talking about how coeducation came to be here.
Well, coeducation, talk about coeducation goes back into the late 1800s, 1888, 1896, 1898. There are references in publications here to coeducation and what it might do for the school and what it might do to the school.
I actually found a reference that one of the debating societies debated it in 1873.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I would love to have a transcript of that debate, but of course that doesn't exist.
Well, as we went through the study that did result in the decision to become coeducational, I did a little bit of research on earlier manifestations of coeducation interest, and I came across some interesting references. One professor in particular in the late 1800s really was very strongly in support of coeducation, and I featured him in a little piece I did for the Alumni Magazine about a brief history of co-education at Washington. He thought it was essential that we teach young women. He also was quoted, I ended up the article by saying, I quoted him, he said, "We are headed toward a precipice." And I said, was he talking about co-education? No, he was talking about fancy dress. He didn't like the idea of the women out there in the frilly dresses that were in vogue at that time. And I said, he wanted women in their place. He thought it was in the classroom, not on the dance floor.
Now, who was this?
A professor. His name was Hoag. I'd have to look it up. I don't carry his full name in my head, but he was quite a thorn in the side, I think, of the faculty. He was always challenging him on things.
And when was this?
This was in the late 1800s, about 1898, around there, somewhere that time, 1896.
Boy, that's interesting.
And but he was. He was a real advocate of co-education, one of the first outspoken advocates for it. It doesn't turn up too often. I can recall in my own experience when we were engaged in our first institutional self-study by which we achieved reaccreditation through the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools, Commission on Colleges. They require it every 10 years for an institution to go through a very difficult self-examination as to what their purpose is, how well they fulfill the purpose, and just what it is that they offer, and whether they could be doing a better job. And there are certain standards that you have to meet. So the self-study process is something that colleges must do. I don't know of any that really like to do it, although it can be a very useful exercise, and it has always proven so here at Washington Lee. But in 1964, 65, and 66, when we were engaged in this self-study, I can remember it working on a statement of institutional philosophy, and I was preparing some paragraphs that would stimulate the thinking of others on the self-study steering committee. And I remember saying that trying to get them to free their minds from any shackles that limited the way in which they could perceive Washington Lee in the future. And I remember I conceded that with the exception of admitting women to Washington Lee, we should not have any other impediments to change. I was willing to concede that at the time, that Washington Lee would not ever admit women. And at the time I said that, this was on the edge. If you think in the mid-60s, this was on the edge of the great transition that began shortly after that at Princeton and Dartmouth and other previously all-men's colleges began accepting women and became co-educational. And then it spread and eventually ate up almost all of the men's colleges. I remember in 1956, President Gaines was so proud, and I was the publicity director at that time, and it was my job to take this morsel of integrity and quality and make sure it got proper play in the newspapers. Washington Lee was chosen by the Chicago Tribune as one of the 10 best men's colleges in the United States. And I found occasion once to remark somewhat playfully, that's my inclination to remark, make facetious remarks. I said, if Dr. Gaines were alive today, he'd be proud of it. We didn't prove we were one of the best of the, we were among the top five men's colleges in the United States because we were down to about five left. And among that five, perhaps we could have claimed to be the best. But in any event, though, he was very proud of that. But I lost my train of thought there. What was I? Why did I go back to 56 and mention that?
We were talking about, well, last thing I jotted down, you were talking about self-studies.
Oh, yeah, the self-study. And We did not spend a lot of time thinking about coeducation in the first self-study. By the time we got around to 1978, I think I'm correct in this, but again, I would have to check the documentation on it. We made it plain to the visiting committee and to the Southern Association that we were not unaware of the possibility of improving the institution by admitting women. I think we noted for their information that we had engaged in a self-study in 1970, and we had engaged in another study of self-study, another study of coeducation, in 1975-76. And our next institutional self-study that we had a visiting committee come forward would be in 1978, as I recall. So we were aware of it, but they did. It was not in the purview of the Southern Association of Colleges and Schools to say you got to become co-ed. I mean, there are many fine women's colleges and several men's colleges. Maybe not several, but at the time several that are in the Southern Association remain single sex. So they aren't going to go out and say, well, we aren't going to credit you unless you're a co-ed. So, but we like to convince these visiting committees that we are intellectually alive here and aware of what's going on around us. So I can say I think it did turn up in that report. Well, then the notion of coeducation was on our minds, and I can speak from personal experience here. I do know that when we began to work on some very serious capital projects, major building needs that had to be addressed there in the early 70s. I know that in the work we did at Doremus Gymnasium, the expansion into what is now known as the Warner Center, as we were doing that, we were aware that what we were doing there would be very easy to adapt for women students. And when we built the law school, we built the law school knowing that we might have women in the law school. And indeed, that had come to pass even before we got into the new building. But from the beginning, coeducation in the law school was anticipated. And as we added the new university undergraduate library, now the James G. Leyburn Library, coeducation was anticipated there. So almost all of our planning assumptions as we worked our way through these major needs and into some subordinate physical improvements, almost always was done consciously with looking ahead to the future and thinking of how would this work if we had women students. And I recall specifically when Bob Huntley became president in 1968, in the fall of 1968, he was addressing an organization, I don't think it exists here anymore, but at that time it was called the Parents Advisory Council. And this was a group of 25 or 30 parents, couples mainly, who would meet with us at least once a year, sometimes more often, to share with us their perceptions and their sense of what Washington Lee was doing right and what it was doing wrong. And I recall when Bob was talking to that first group that he met with as president, someone asked him, now when is Washington Lee going to become co-ed? And he was always very thoughtful in his responses, and he said, well, I can't say for certain when Washington Lee will become co-ed or if Washington Lee will become co-ed. But what I can say is I doubt if Washington Lee, or I think it will be unlikely if Washington Lee permits itself to go out of business offering an alternative that no one wants. And so with that in mind, I know Bob Huntley's eye was always on the future here and whether or not Washington Lee would find itself in a position where its best course of action would be to become coeducational. About 2 years, or within 2 years of having made that statement, Washington Lee had engaged in its first study of coeducation. And that study was not directed toward bringing forth a recommendation that we remain all male or become coeducational. The purpose of that study was to examine the consequences of a move to coeducation. What would be the consequences of a move to coeducation? And this study was accomplished by looking at several models. One model envisioned that we would remain the same size and accept women as some fraction of that total enrollment. Another model suggested that we would keep the same number of men, but we would add women in some ratio. And I think a third model was what we sometimes refer to as a sex-blind admissions policy, where we'd let things seek its own level. And we haven't quite achieved that yet, but I can only speculate as to how quickly that'll come about, but I think it is going to come about. I think that we will, at some point, depart from our efforts to maintain what has become, and I'm generalizing here, a 60-40 ratio of men to women.
So, all right, we're up to about 1970 now.
Well, this is the study in 70. And then the charge that Bob Huntley got from the Board of Trustees, as I recall, this was one of the very first meetings where I sat through the whole board meeting as his assistant. And I remember them discussing this report, and the charge was that they instructed him to thank the committee that had worked very hard on this. It was very, very good leadership under Professor Hodges, Lewis Hodges, as the chairman of the committee, Professor Tom Amason, who is no longer with Washington Lee, but one of our very fine chemistry professors, worked very hard on it. So the board said, well, thank the committee for the good work and tell them that we will not take any action on the report at this time, other than to ask the president to keep them informed of anything they ought to know about coeducation. And so President Huntley proceeded to do that. He visited, got to know the presidents of colleges that were making the transition. He found out, would ask them why they were doing it, what compelled them to make the move. He took all this to heart and then took it back to the Board of Trustees. Meanwhile, considerable pressure built within the university, not only from the faculty who saw coeducation as a means toward improving the academic quality of the institution, but from the students. And the student attitude would vary from one year to the next there in the 70s. They were against coeducation in 1973 in an informal poll, but were for it in 1974. They were for it in 1978, but against it in 1979. It almost depended upon who was carrying the flag and who was waving it the most vigorously. So
who would conduct a poll like that?
Well, the students would do it themselves. I think I'm correct in this, that these were student polls. Every now and then, the faculty, there'd be some kind of a straw vote among the faculty to establish the point of view that the institution should take another look at it. So there was sufficient pressure around 1974, 75, I guess, that the Board of Trustees decided that they would conduct another study. And this time the board itself would take the initiative, and there would be a board study committee under the chairmanship of Frank Brooks of Baltimore. I hope I don't do Frank Brooks and the others who served on that committee, I think Gordon Leggett, whose wife now serves on the Board of Trustees, I know Gordon was on the committee. I don't I don't want to do them a disservice, but I don't think that their hearts were really in it. It was to them, it was a tough thing to get their arms around, and I think their initiative sort of languished for a time there, and I think President Huntley himself saw that this study was likely to be, well, he never said this, but this is my assessment, that the trustee study might prove to be an embarrassment to the trustees unless they went about it in a little more orderly way. And I recall one of the things that President Huntley did to stimulate their thinking was to sit down and to list the reasons why Washington Lee should become coeducational, and then he listed the reasons why we should not, the pros and the cons. Well, I learned something from him about law at that time. I learned a lot about law from him, little bits and pieces here and there. But I discovered that sometimes when you don't put down the pros and cons of an issue, they don't really balance each other out. Sometimes if you say something, reason for becoming coeducational, some of the reasons for not don't exactly speak to the other issue. So what he did was he went back, and for all those reasons why Washington Lee should become coeducational, he would give the rebuttal to that reason. And he did the same thing for the reasons why we should remain all male. He gave the rebuttals to those. And it was a very interesting exercise to read over what he did there. And he turned that over to the committee, and indeed it did stimulate their thinking. And there was there were other activities that went on within the university, studies done. I remember Professor Bob McAaron, I believe, was involved in, let me be careful here, I may be confusing one study with another. I'd have to check that. But there were supporting studies here done on behalf of the trustees, and the information turned over to them. I know a lot of financial models were run at the time. So the upshot was, at that time in 1976, when this when the report was made a part of the trustees' agenda and was acted upon, the action at that time was that they saw no compelling reason that Washington Lee should admit undergraduate women at that time. I think the report noted that we now had women in the law school, and that seemed to be going well, but they saw no compelling reason at that time why Washington Lee should accept undergraduate women. And whether it, I don't recall whether it said specifically, but it certainly was implicit in that statement that they expected to keep their eyes open and be alert to reasons that might become compelling.
Now, would the board have, at the same time they're coming to this conclusion, this is the same time when the faculty is feeling that the quality of the average student is slipping?
Yes.
Would the board have been aware of that?
The board probably was not as aware of it then as it would be today. The mechanism or the structure was not quite in place at that time, if my memory serves me correctly. We had established in a reorganization of the board in the early 70s a very effective committee structure, and I'm not certain that the Academic Affairs Committee or the Student Life Committee had come into existence at that time. I would have to check that to make certain. And certainly if the way in which those committees function today, they would discover this attitude on the part of faculty, on the part of students. I mean, the avenues of communication are wide open now compared to what we had in the 70s, because we were just making a transition from a board whose members were chosen and served for life, or until they retired, and most of them did not retire. Death would take them away. we were moving from a self-perpetuating board into a different type of board that had mandatory retirement at age 70. Trustees were elected for specific terms of 6 years. You could serve two consecutive terms for, and then there was a requirement that even if you had still had time remaining before you would reach age 70, you would have to step down as a trustee for at least a year, at which time you could be reelected. And in one case, this happened. We happened to reelect a man who was a very severe critic of coeducation, and he served about a year or so in his third term on the board, and then he resigned, and the purpose of his resignation was to lead the fight against coeducation. So I guess to address your question, the trustees were not as aware at that moment. They were getting more and more aware. Bob Huntley was a very effective communicator with the board. I mean, he and he instituted the policy of others among his senior staff of meeting with the board. So there were increased opportunities for members of the Board of Trustees to talk with the Dean of Students, to talk with the Dean of the College, the Dean of the Commerce School, the Dean of the Law School, and by means both informal and formal to have a better sense of what was going on and these additional perspectives presented to them. And in addition to Bob Huntley's own superb ability to communicate with them.
What was Bob Huntley's take on co-ed education? I mean, I know I'll be talking to him, but what's your sense of this?
Well, I think Bob's vision of the future was that it was inevitable that we would become co-ed.
Was it something inevitable that he desired, or was it something inevitable that he dreaded?
As the father of three daughters, I think he probably would not have minded it. Never really pressed him on it. I remember we circulated among the administration and members of the faculty. We may have even mentioned it in the alumni magazine, but there was a very eloquent article that appeared in the Princeton Alumni Weekly. And I can remember everything about it except the person's name. I can remember why he was someone of note. He was a graduate of Princeton. He wrote the book for the musical that played on Broadway and elsewhere too, based upon the Peanuts comic strip, You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. And he wrote under the title, We Were Never Allowed to Mourn. And it was a lament that men's colleges had passed from the scene so quickly that there hadn't been time for those who admired them to lament their passing and to realize what it was we were losing until it essentially had all gone. And his, I guess his remarks would be branded sexist today. But what he said was, I think, stands up, and it certainly would prove valid for women's colleges as well. He said that in the single-sex college, and here he was talking about the male college. He wasn't talking about the women, but he was addressing the men's college. He said there was a certain elegance to it, that was something that we now refer to as male bonding, you know, and good old boy networks and all the other almost pejorative terms that are associated with that, but he expressed it in a very elegant way. He talked about the camaraderie and the good feelings, and if I remember correctly, you may have drawn some parallels to serving together in the military, the same kind of shared experiences causing a good feeling, and that education itself was valid. In that, to the extent that men and women do occasionally distract each other, at least it removed that distraction from those of academic had their academic purposes laid out for them.
That sounds like a nice article. I'd like to track that down. We need to turn the tape over.
All righty.